From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. An ambassador travels to the capital of a foreign empire, only to discover that her predecessor has died in baffling circumstances. That's the start of the new novel, A Memory Called Empire. The space opera weaves together the intrigue of a political thriller with the rich intricacies of an alien world. Author Arkady Martin describes why she loves the sci-fi genre.
So these questions about assimilation and these questions about political negotiation and what is worth sacrificing and what isn't, I think people grapple with every day. But when I put them in a science fictional setting where they're sort of kicked up to 11, then there's an intensity and a deliberate focus that you can get to.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org. Good morning. This is On the Record. I'm Nathan Sterner, sitting in for Sheila Cast. Baltimore-based author Arkady Martin has just released her new novel, her debut novel, titled A Memory Called Empire. It is a book about, well, memory and empire and politics and poetry and diplomacy and so much more. It is being hailed as one of the biggest sci-fi fantasy books of the year, and Arkady is here to talk to us about it. Thank you so much for coming on the record.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm really glad to be here.
So I read an interview where you were quoted as saying, writing a novel is the worst thing I have ever done to myself on purpose.
Oh my God, yeah,
tell us about the experience.
I said that in an interview when I was about halfway through writing this. And this is actually the first full-length work of fiction that I've ever completed. Like, I've written many, many, many short stories, but I'd never written a novel before I did this one. The longest thing I'd ever written before this was a PhD dissertation, which was actually shorter than the novel. And, oh my God, there are so many words in a novel. It goes on and on forever. And as someone who came out of writing short stories as my primary mode of creative expression, I spent a lot of learning curve on realizing that, yeah, you have to keep writing the novel. You have to do it every day, or at least like a lot of days, for months at a time. And I think when I gave that interview quote, I was about two-thirds of the way through the first draft and just feeling like I was never not going to be writing this book. I currently disagree with what I said then. It is not the worst thing I ever did to myself on purpose by a long way. But
it has become something you would very much enjoy.
Oh, yeah. I'm very proud of this book. I'm very proud of the work I did and honored by the reception that it's been getting and the help I've gotten from my agent and my editor and my publisher to bring it to the world. And since I'm writing another one, I better get used to liking it.
So this is a new and entirely different world. Did you sort of set everything out first, how it was going to come together, or did things come to you as you went on?
It's a combination of both, really. I'm not one of those people who sits down and writes out absolutely everything. I don't actually have one of those binders full of world-building documents like some sci-fi fantasy authors do. But I had a aesthetic sense that I wanted to hit, and I knew what that was very early on. So I knew I wanted to combine elements of the Byzantine Empire, which is what I studied when I was a academic. The Empire of the Mexica, the Aztecs that we know them as, a little bit of the Mongols, and some sort of Star Wars-y big space opera stuff. So I knew what I wanted it to feel like.
And now that you mention the Aztecs, I see all of the sun imagery that is throughout this
book.
Sun
and blood sacrifice, that's pretty much pulled from there. And there is a lot of similarities politically between the ideology that the Aztecs had and the ideology that the Byzantines had. Both of them were late medieval, early modern, universalizing empires that believed that like their empire is the center of the world and the correct center of the world.
And the empire in your book, Takes Kalan, is the center of the universe in its own mind, spreading ever outward, bringing civilization to the barbarians. And to anyone who is not a Teixkalani, everyone's a barbarian, right?
Oh, yeah. And this comes straight out of the work I had done as a Byzantinist on ideas of what made someone a Byzantine Roman and what made someone not. You can learn the language and you can acquire all the customs. You can change your name. You can live in the city. You're still a barbarian. And this is one of the horrible things about imperialism and assimilation is that empire says you can't win. And that's one of the things I really wanted to explore in this book.
That's Baltimore author Arkady Martin. We're talking about her debut novel, a space opera titled A Memory Called Empire. So I want to begin with, well, pretty much the beginning of the book, describing what Teixkalan brings to everything that is outside the empire. Would you read that for us?
Yeah, sure. So this is actually from the first page of the book. This scene, some captain staring out at the holograph recreation of empire past the demarcated edge of the world. Pick a border, pick a spoke of that great wheel that is Teixkalan's vision of itself and find it repeated. 100 such captains, 100 such holographs. And each and every one of those captains has led troops down into a new system, carrying all the poison gifts she can muster. Trade agreements and poetry, taxes and the promise of protection, black-muzzled energy weapons and the sweeping architecture of a new governor's palace, built around the open, many-rayed heart of a sun temple.
Bringing culture into new places to the barbarians, and in so doing, changing them.
Yes. Teixkalan is an empire that I very deliberately wrote to echo the worst kind of cultural imperialism that exists in the real world. It is a place that believes that its culture is the correct culture and that other people should be glad to have access to it. And they're here to help if you want to be helped. And if you don't want to be helped, you might just have to do it anyway.
You might be helped anyway.
Yeah.
Teixkalan is a culture of excess or luxury, of having everything it needs. But the main character of this book is not from Teixkalan, but from a space station called La Salle. And that is a culture of scarcity, of using everything. It's a very different way of seeing the world.
This is true, and that has to do with the fact that there are 30,000 people in a little metal shell floating in space. Mm-hmm. So La Salle Station is a refinery and mine. They're kind of floating in a good gravitational well near a system and an asteroid field, and they mine various things, and then they refine them into other stuff and sell them. So they're a merchant concern. Really, really limited resources because they don't have a planet, so they grow all their own food hydroponically. They conserve oxygen. They conserve people, and that's one of the major plot points in the book is that they have a technology that allows them to pass knowledge down from one generation to another generation with almost no loss.
And we have to take a break, and I want to talk to you about that when we are back. This is Baltimore-based author Arkady Martin here on The Record. The book is A Memory Called Empire, and we will have more on it in a moment. Stay with us. This is the On the Record podcast, a service of your public radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Nathan Sterner, sitting in today for Sheila Cast, and I am talking with Arkady Martin, author of the new novel, A Memory Called Empire. And let's talk about memory now, or the key memory plot point of the book, the imago device?
Imago, actually.
Imago device?
Yeah. An imago has two meanings in standard American English. One of them comes from psychology. An imago is the sort of echoed person, the person you wish you were. And that comes out of like Jungian psychology. And the other thing in imago is what happens after you go through a chrysalis in etymology when you talk about insects. So it's a really interesting word. And I use it to describe the technology that LaSalle Station has developed to pass on memory between different generations. Because again, as I was saying before, they've only got 30,000 people. And if you're going to run a whole civilization on 30,000 people, you don't have all that much room for error.
You can't afford to lose knowledge and ability.
Especially in a dangerous place like a space station where people die in accidents all the time. So the imago machines, the imago technology, is a way of putting one person's memory into the memory of their
their successor, someone who's going
successor.
To fill their role in the society.
Exactly. So you go from like one skilled pilot to a baby pilot just getting started who suddenly has access to all of this muscle memory and knowledge of celestial navigation that they would have had to learn, and now they don't. LaSalle Station essentially conserves death. They keep people somewhat alive by transferring memory down these lines of inheritance called imago lines. And now this technology is not a real technology, of course. Brains don't actually work like that. No. I asked a neuroscientist friend of mine.
Oh, there's no way this could possibly.
And I apologized to him after he told me that absolutely everything in here was completely impossible. And I said, okay, that's fine. I'm going to do it anyway. I'll just make sure I follow my own rules. So what is fairly consistent about the way that I address memory in this book is that memory is linked up to your endocrine system, to your experiences, to your sensory impressions. And even though in the world of this novel, people from LaSalle can share memories and sort of minds with the dead, their predecessors, those memories are highly linked to how compatible the predecessor and the descendant are.
So the main character, Mahit Dismar, is going to the city of Texcalan. And she's doing so because the representative from LaSalle to Texcalan has been murdered.
She doesn't know that to begin with. All she knows is that he needs to be replaced. She doesn't really know what happened to him before she leaves. But yeah, the inciting incident of the plot is the Texcalani Empire sends an envoy to LaSalle and is like, we need a new ambassador, thanks. And LaSalle panics a bit because they don't know what happened to the previous ambassador, and there have been various problems with him anyway, which I shall not spoil. So they find a new one, and they send Mahit, but they send her with some help. The help is the version of the previous ambassador who was last recorded into an imago machine. So she's supposed to have
some knowledge
with her, except he's 15 years out of date because he hasn't updated his machine in a while. And when she does get to the city, the heart of the world, the jewel of the world, they have a lot of names for it. The very first thing that happens to her is she discovers that her predecessor, Yaskandar Agaven, is in fact dead. He is dead and she can go look at his corpse. Which is distressing for both her and the version of Yaskandar who is hanging out inside her head. And she immediately suspects foul play because they're clearly trying to cover something up. But the first half of the book is her trying to figure out whether there was foul play, and if so, who was responsible, and is she in danger? And the answer to that is pretty much yes, definitely she's in danger. Thanks, Yaskandar. You did some real interesting stuff. So the book opens on a murder mystery. And from there, it becomes a political thriller based on what is discovered in the course of investigating that murder.
And this is all of these themes and many more in this book. Science fiction set in space, but this is so much about diplomacy. This is so much about interacting of people. I mean, there are explosions and there are riots, but it's not as if this is a battle-themed book at all. This is an interaction-themed and a exploring consciousness-themed book. At least that's how I saw it.
Yeah. I mean, I call it a space opera because it is a space opera in the deeply traditional sense. But it's a space opera by way of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. It's a spy thriller and a political argument. And I love what science fiction lets you do in terms of focusing big humanistic ideas and not looking at them in their contexts as we see them and encounter them every day in the world, but in a way that sort of lets you take them out of their setting and turn around the jewel and look through the facets. So these questions about assimilation and these questions about political negotiation and what is worth sacrificing and what isn't and what is the nature of the self, all of these are questions that I think people grapple with every day. But when I put them in a science fictional setting where they're sort of kicked up to 11, then there's an intensity and a deliberate focus that you can get to. This is one of the reasons that I love writing science fiction and probably will always write science fiction.
This is a world in which poetry is incredibly important.
Yes. I love that I got to do that. I feel like I've gotten away with something. So Tixkalan is a culture where poetry and the performance of poetry and the composition and remembering of poetry is a mark of being a cultured, educated person. A lot of their politics is conducted through propaganda in the form of poetry, or poetry in the form of propaganda, depending on which way you're looking. And all of that comes straight out of 9th to 12th century Byzantium. It is all true. The medieval Greeks did that.
Really? That was how society was run, through poetry?
It's how the court, not exactly as much as I have it in Tixkalan, but in
it's
terms
of... It's the language of diplomacy, the language of...
The language of the court and the political negotiation between factions had so much to do in Byzantium with, did you know your Homer? Did you know how to quote the right line at the right time? Could you compose a encomia, a praise poem about the emperor on command with reference to other encomia that had been written about other emperors who you were trying to evoke? And having that skill was not only how you showed that you were educated, but how you gained political power for yourself and for your faction, your allies.
And that's how it works in Tixkalan.
Exactly. This I lifted straight from history.
There is a very climactic scene in the middle of the book in which a poem is the climax of it. Would you, even without context, I think this poem is beautiful. Would you read this for us?
Sure. Every skyport harbor overflows. Citizens carry armfuls of imported flowers. These things are ceaseless. Star charts, disembarkments. The curl of unborn petals holds a hollowness.
It's so beautiful.
Thank you.
You're listening to On the Record. I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Sheila Cass today, speaking with historian and author Arkady Martin, whose new novel, A Memory Called Empire, comes out next week. Number names. I wanted to get into this really quickly. The Tixkalani have these special names that are comprised of a number, and I'm not completely sure on the rules. Usually something alive?
Yeah. Not something alive. Usually a plant. I guess plants are alive. So the number noun names are something that I was inspired by Central American culture to use. Names like six jaguar are the kinds of things that lords of the Mexica and the Teotihuacan peoples called themselves. So I thought that was just, that's such a great way of describing someone. And for Central American people, that's linked up to a ceremonial calendar that has 216 days. So like which thing you're named after has to do with what day you're born on. For Tixkalanli, that in my made-up version, it's not nearly so linked, but the numbers and the nouns all have symbolic meanings. Low numbers are traditional, higher numbers are like sort of new money. Some numbers have particular connotations. 3 is for stability and also for like aggression because it's pointy. Like if you think of a triangle, triangle's pointy.
And so the names we have include things like...
Oh, yeah. So some of the names are things like 3 seagrass, 19 ads, the emperor, 6 direction, the imperial heir, 8 antidote, the minister for science, 10 pearl, that kind of stuff. And the rules for the nouns are objects, concepts. So you could have something like perihelion, I guess. And plants, but no animals, nothing that could move on its own.
So the empire here, there are references to it, and maybe I've missed something, but there are references to it having formed while the civilization was planet bound.
Yes.
Does it spoil anything, can I ask? Is this us? Is this meant to be us or not?
Maybe.
Because I can't really, there's no reason to think, but there's no reason to think not.
That's exactly what I intended. So if this universe is a universe that is ours, then it's about 7,000 years in the future. And the location of humanity's planet of origin is obscured completely. I personally don't exactly know if the Tezcalanli came from Earth. I don't think the Empire came from Earth. I think they were a... Their planet of origin was not Earth. They may have come from Earth before they got there. But all of this is so far back in the mists of history. What I wanted to do with separating this story from connections with a possible future is to have the freedom to really explore without needing to hook up, and this is how we could plausibly get there from here. So if you want to believe that it's our future, that's totally legit. And if you don't, that's also totally legit.
So when I finished this book, it's so often that when you read books that are part of a series, that you know that there's something else has to happen because it doesn't feel complete. I didn't realize that this was not standalone until I saw online that you were writing a sequel to it. I mean, yes, there are a lot of questions that haven't been answered, but it doesn't feel at all unsatisfying. Did you know there was going to be a follow-up?
I had ideas for what that could be, but part of that was that when I sold this book, my publisher, Tor Macmillan, was interested in seeing a sequel, and I had ideas for one. I'd been thinking of them as I wrote, and I thought, okay, well, let's see what I can do. But I wrote the book to be complete, and I will write the sequel to also be a complete book that you can read essentially on its own. I think of these less as a sequence and more of a series that has complete parts. They're all in the same world. They have some of the same characters, but each book is its own thing.
Did you jump right into writing the second book after finishing the first, or did you have to take a break?
I took a couple months. I got married, and I wrote a bunch of short stories and got 3/4 of a master's degree. But then, I mean, it was only a couple of months. I'm headed towards the end of the draft of book 2 right now.
This year, you're also serving as guest editor for Year 4 of Reckoning, a journal of creative writing on environmental justice. What does that entail?
So I was lucky enough to be invited to do this by Reckoning's founder, Michael DeLuca. And I've been talking a lot about how I have been a historian of the Byzantine Empire, but what I do now is I'm a city planner. And I'm a city planner who's incredibly interested in climate change and sustainability and green cities. So when Michael was looking for guest editors and we'd met through a mutual friend, it was sort of a serendipitous moment. So Reckoning is a journal which explores the connection between humans and the environment in a multitude of ways. Fictional ways, in non-fictional ways. We have poetry. I don't edit the poetry. A wonderful editor named Danica Dismore edits the poetry. And for the issue that I'm editing, I'm specifically exploring the built environment and humans' relationship to the built environment in both fiction and non-fiction.
And you're accepting submissions for that, right?
I am, yes. If you go to the Reckoning website, then it is an easy submissions process. We use a submission system called Moksha, and we'll get back to you within about a month, hopefully. And submissions should be open at least until June, if not longer.
Well, thank you so much for coming in to talk about this book.
Thank you for having me. It's been lovely.
Arkady Martin's debut novel, A Memory Called Empire, is out next Tuesday, March 26th. That evening, she'll be appearing at the Ivy Bookshop, 6080 Falls Road, for a reading and launch event from 7 to 9 p.m. We have a link to details about that on the Record page at wypr.org. I'm Nathan Sterner here on The Record. Thanks so much for listening. Join us again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks!